Hello, welcome to episode number 185 of the Apologue Podcast. I'm your host, Simon Head. Today's podcast is brought to you in part by BetterHelp.com. Get affordable private online counseling anytime, anywhere, and you can talk with a licensed professional therapist online, and you can enter the code word Apologue when you go to BetterHelp.com/Apologue, and you get a free 7-day trial with the code word. And I'd also like to thank all the people shopping on Amazon to help the show out. You too can help the show out by going to apologue.ca/Amazon or apologue.ca/US Amazon. Or you can go the old-fashioned way by going to apologue.ca, click on those banners located on the right side, locate your country, and bookmark all those links. And every time you shop on Amazon, use those links to shop and support the show. Costs you no extra money. I'd like to thank my patrons. And you can become a patron too by going to patreon.com/apologue. Pledge as much or as little as you want on a monthly basis to help with hosting and gas fees, and you can cancel at any time. If you want to go buy a t-shirt, buy some music, go to apologue.ca/shop. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes. Give it 5 stars, please. Like the show on Facebook by going to facebook.com/apologuepod. And follow me on Twitter at SimonHead666. Today on the show, I have Mr. Michael Barclay. Michael Barclay is an author. He's written on a few books, but the most present book he's written is called The Never-Ending Present, The Story of Gord Downie and the Tragically Hip. It came out in April of this year, so it's very recently just came out. So I was actually, my only reason I kind of tried to contact with Michael was because I know he had written on something that had to do with the band Slow. And I just had Tom from Slow on the band, so I asked him over Facebook, hey, and turns out he wrote this book. So here we are talking about, not just about the book, but other things, the Canadian music industry in general, being an author, and how cool that is. Here he is, Michael Barclay, on the Apologue Podcast.
Yeah, what are we talking about here today?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. You.
Sure.
I was looking around because I had Tom from Slow on, and I saw that you were credited in a book that you were part of a contributing factor to the book. And then I looked further, and then I realized you had written some other things based, like, you know, Tragically Hip stuff and things like this. And I thought, wow, that's an awesome... resume? Is that a resume?
Yes. Yeah. Two books. Two books is a good resume.
It's one of those things that as a, you look on the outside and go, that seems like a fascinating trip, you know, writing a book. And it seems such on the, for me, like, cause I write music and I don't really paint or I do things, but I look at things that I can't do and go, that's fascinating. Like that's, you know, it's interesting because I have no idea where to start. I'd love to do it one day, but I don't know the premise and how to start and where to go. And when you started writing, did you take any training for this?
No, never. Well, I mean, as much as any formal education is training, I studied history at university. So you learn how to research and you learn how to synthesize and you learn how to write. But I learned as much, if not more, working at the school paper and the school radio station. Mm-hmm. I mean, the best advice I give to writers is just to write. Even before you go to school and try and make yourself better at it, the two best things you can do is to read and write and read and write. And that's true of anything. That's true of music as well.
That's true. I mean, as you get older, musicians get better. The problem is when it's an image-based profession, so therefore you have a sort of a shelf life as a musician. But then there's also the other side of it where you write for commercials and you write for TV, and there's no image-based. I guess that would be the closest thing to being an author or to writing a book.
Yeah, but my point is, I guess to just keep doing it, and then you get better and you figure things out. And if you find yourself not getting better, then maybe you should do something else.
Yeah. Do you write in your voice? Because this is something somebody told me this. Because I always do a little blurb at the start of this, and someone said, "Oh, I like it. Sounds like you talking." I'm like, "Okay, that is that good? Is that bad?" I mean, they knew me obviously who I was as a person, but the phrasing I use translates into what I write. And so when you write, do you write on a clinical point of view, or do you write based in your voice? Like how what's your process?
It depends on who I'm writing for. Obviously, I've done a lot of, dry news pieces in my time, or I'll write a bio for somebody. there's a lot of instances where you do not want to use your voice because that's not called for. But in a lot of my pieces in my books, I like to be somewhat informal, not too informal, but I want it to be very approachable. I cannot stand academic writing. And, I've read a lot of books where the writing is just too dry. Mm-hmm. I would like the reader to think that they get a sense of who I am or what it would be like to converse. I want it to be a little bit like if I'm telling you a story, if we're out at a bar or over a video link for a podcast. I want that to come through in the writing.
Yeah, there's a sense of imagery that you create when you write, when you write. So therefore, you're kind of letting people into what you're writing and creating their own images in their head. And to me, that's good writing because also even with songwriting, because people write songs and you can create your own conclusion and your own storyline, and it might mean nothing to what you think about it. And writing is a little different because you kind of need to make a point. I mean, it needs to start somewhere. And is there anything out there that sort of that just doesn't, I mean, and there is writing out there that has like a pointlessness to it, but it's the pointless is the reason why you write. Does it make sense?
Yeah. And I mean, there's fine lines and there's blurred lines and there's a lot of stuff that is, too informal, or it sounds like the writer's just writing for themselves, or they're just writing to prove how clever they are. And that doesn't register with me. And there's some very acclaimed writers who write like that, and they're very popular, but that doesn't turn my crank. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And at the same time, you do want to, I think I try and talk just slightly, not over the head, but, you don't want to talk down to your audience. You want them to think a little bit about what you're saying. And certainly in the book I just wrote, there's a lot of metaphor or like tangents where I'm talking about something else to really illustrate the point I'm trying to make. It seems like a tangent, but this quote I have from somebody is really making a larger point of what they're actually talking about.
Yeah, and this is the Tragically Hip book you're speaking of. Is this that?
Just came out last month, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, based on the lyrics obviously are, if you listen to Gord Downie's lyrics, they're so, they're either on they're the coded. Nose or they're just, yeah, or they're really smooth sounding. And to be able to pull, like you say, a tangent, you're writing based on what somebody you'd heard. And are you writing on stories you've heard with Gord Downie and with the Tragically Hip, or are you writing based on, are you using like their material to sort of make points in your story?
The book is kind of, It is a chronological history of the band, in some ways a straight up biography, drawn from the historical record. They didn't speak to me, for this project specifically. Mm-hmm. I had interviewed them, the last 2 years being rather emotionally wrong and understandable that they weren't talking. Mm-hmm. So I pulled from the historical record, but then I did several dozen interviews, around 80 interviews with producers of the records, people they toured with, old friends from Kingston, the extended circle, people who played on the solo projects, the extended circle. So there's lots of primary source research here. And in some ways it's their story told through everyone else's eyes. It's a series of love letters from people who worked with them about how that process was. And but every second chapter in the book is also thematic. So I interrupt the narrative to, you know, if we're talking about the Fully Completely album, I don't talk about the song 50 Mission Cap in that album, but then the next chapter is just about hockey. And it's about 50 Mission Cap, and it's about their other songs about hockey. It's about their personal relationships with the game, but hockey songs in general, which is, you know, there's not a long list of those. Mm-hmm. And then another chapter will just be about the myth that they were unsuccessful in the States, right? And so I kind of take all the American anecdotes about this band and put them into one chapter and say, okay, well, let's examine how successful were they and what does it mean and does it matter and all that stuff. And there's a chapter, you know, when I write about Gord Downie's first solo record, Coke Machine Glow, the next chapter after that is just about his lyrics and poetry because he published a book of poetry at the same time mm-hmm. he did that. So mm-hmm. it's a chronological history of the band interspersed with essays on themes that this band's career, you know, forces you to think about things a bit deeper and paint a broader picture too. So mm-hmm. it's certainly a book about the tragedy of Hip, but it's also about... it's about a lot of bands in Canada, and in some ways it's about every musician's journey, you know, like there's a chapter later in the book about what it means to get old in a band. What does it mean to be in a band when you're in your 50s playing rock and roll music, and how do you get people to care about your 12th record? What's into yours? So there's a lot of just general music stuff, general culture stuff that I think will appeal to any musician in this country in particular, but also just anyone interested in culture. Mm-hmm.
There's an amazing podcast I listen to called Dig Me Out, and they talk about the Tragically Hip, and it's an American podcast, and they're based out of Toledo. And what I took away from their love of, because they go over the Tragically Hip's Fully Completely album, track for track, and they talk about it, and they talk about how special it is to them. And obviously when resonating with your, they weren't that successful in the United States, one might argue that their fans in the United States were a little more true to, based on the per capita of fan, the person that was into the Hip from the States was like, that's my band. You know what I mean? And
of course, you know. Absolutely. Absolutely. And they did do very well in the States. You know, Ian Blurton of Change of Heart told me, you know, I know 300 bands who would kill to be as quote unquote unsuccessful as the Hip were in the States. Yeah. You know, like they played like a 1,000 seat theaters, like in almost every market. Right. And they were very popular in Chicago and in Texas and mm-hmm. Boston, Arizona, you know, but they're kind of popular in geographically dispersed areas. So it's not like they were just an Eastern Seaboard band. You know what I mean? And they never had media on their side. That's where they were unsuccessful. So they never played the Tonight Show or Letterman, and they were never in Rolling Stone or Spin. Mm-hmm. So, but because that's how Canadians perceive American success is through the media, right? Because we consume so much American media. So, if we don't see them in that media, then we think they're unsuccessful, when really they are a very successful cult band, you mm-hmm. know? Mm-hmm. And like if you're playing, I live in Toronto. Are you in Toronto?
I'm just outside of Toronto, yeah.
Okay, so like if you're playing the venues the size of or as large as Massey Hall all across the States, you are a successful band, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the most interesting things that's happened to me since this book came out was I was invited to Buffalo. I booked a bunch of like author events myself in, you know, small towns and big cities around Ontario, but I was invited to come to Buffalo and open up, if you will, for a Hip cover band called the Strictly Hip. And this band sells out a 300 seat venue every single month, and they have for the last 15 years or so. Mm-hmm. And I went down there and I read part of the American chapter from the book, and I sold a whole bunch of books after. Like, these Buffalo fans were so excited that I was there, that the piece I read acknowledged their existence because they feel written out of the narrative. For all the rah-rah Canada's banned thing, for all the fact that Canadians love to cling to this fact that they're our secret, mm-hmm. American fans feel negated, left out of that narrative. And so just me showing up in Buffalo and giving a reading, we're like, thank you for telling the story of the tragedy of the hip that includes us.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's sort of like, I would imagine being sort of the tragically hip becoming super successful in Canada to become super successful in America would be a completely different trip based on the fact that, okay, 1,000-seat venue. I mean, there's a band out there, Death Cab for Cutie, and they've played for 1,500 people a night for 25 years. And,
yeah.
You know, and that's sort of their, that's how as big as they can get, but they can do things on their own terms at that point, and they don't have to really... Yeah. Play this role of rock stars. They're still people who play music that people can associate themselves to, and that's always been the hip. Has always been like, I see myself, whether or not I like this particular record, that particular album, there's always something that I see in myself in what they're doing and what they go through, and that was always like to me a resonating point to the hip for me. You know, I play punk rock. I went on tour with punk rock bands and, you know, but there was always this sort of like kindred spirit of they're doing it. They're doing it their way. And they always did. And that was sort of,
yeah, mm-hmm.
it was inspiring, you know?
Yeah. I mean, they operated very independently. They had the luxury of being successful right away. So you can kind of build a firewall around yourself and it makes it easier to say no to things when you're commercially successful.
Yeah.
Early on, they also had very effective management. One half of the team made a lot of money in politics, so they also had a bit of financial cushion at the beginning. But they used their power incredibly effectively well. I mean, they're a very frugal band. You know, they're not prone to excess. They really wanted to mentor bands they enjoyed. They wanted to hire bands like, you know, Change of Heart and Eric's Trip and whoever to go on stage and kick their ass, mm-hmm.
yeah.
and make them play better, and also just really provide a platform for those acts. They really wanted to be, you know, a tide that lifts all boats kind of thing, and there's so many generations of musicians in this country who do owe them a debt, you know, from people their own age, like The Pursuit of Happiness and The Sky Diggers or whoever, to right up to like Fucked Up and Feist, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's just a wide swath of people who benefited directly from their altruism. They owned their own masters and they were with the same major label in Canada the whole time, but they went through four American labels and, you know, they owned all their own things and they had control.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a band. Oh, you've obviously heard of the Weaker Thans. They sort of did the same idea. Only
did you play in Red Fisher with Jason Tate?
I did. Yes, I did.
There you go.
Yeah. 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 Have we met?
I don't think we've met. No, I'm a friend of Jason's. I've known him for a long time. But
I
know John and Julie, and yeah. So,
oh, so are you originally from Winnipeg?
Yes,
are you a Winnipeg guy then?
No,
just know.
No. I just know Winnipeg people because they're awesome. So of course I went.
Yeah, I was a Toronto guy that moved out there to join Red Fisher, and I replaced Brad, original bass player. And then we came to Toronto a few times to play. Mm-hmm. But I used to play in a band before then called Trigger Happy, and we toured.
Yes.
Yeah, we toured across Western Canada, and that's where I sort of met John and Jason. And then they flew. They flew and did a Canadian Music Week or something like that. And then they stayed at my house, and we played some shows with them. And then I ended up just quitting Trigger Happy, moving out to Winnipeg, and joining that band. And it was only like 2 years or something, but it was a big important part of my life. You know, like being in a band like that. You know. That's interesting. You know, even Chewy, like, yeah, that's deep. So when did the first time you saw Red Fisher then? Sounds like the first time I saw.
Oh, I never saw Red Fisher.
No way. Okay. Yeah.
No, I clued into the Weaker Thans 98 or 99.
Yep.
And I was never a big punk rock guy, so people chastised me for not knowing Red Fisher's music. And
it was just power pop. It was just power pop. It wasn't really punk rock. Yeah. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I believe I played shows with Trigger Happy in the early 90s, though.
What was your band?
It's a band that dare not speak its name.
Oh.
It was a hideous named band.
Oh.
But around like 91, 92, I was in this band out of Guelph. And I think we played some shows.
That would have been when I was in Trigger Happy, like with Big Drill Car. And we played with the UK Subs in Guelph. Aaron Riches was the promoter.
Oh, Aaron, yeah.
Yeah.
Good friend of mine, yes.
He's a good man. Yeah. I haven't talked to him in a very long time.
He's a good man.
Yeah.
He's in England. No, actually, he's in Spain, I think, teaching theology.
What? Oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Not theology specifically, but he, theology in English literature, I think.
Okay. Wow.
Biblical motifs and Shakespeare maybe is his academic game. I'm not sure. But yeah, he's been living in Europe for a long time.
Yeah. Now, I think I'm correct when I say this, that he put on like Minor Threat shows in the early days.
Oh, yeah. Fugazi.
And then Fugazi.
No, maybe not Minor Threat, but I don't know about Minor Threat, but I
think
Fugazi.
Fugazi, like he put Fugazi on at like the Cool House or something when it's the government. I think maybe.
He did, yes.
That was like this, hey, we like you. You're a cool guy. You want to come put on a huge show? And he's like, I'm just a dude. I put shows on at the trash. I don't know anything about you.
I think he was still in high school.
Yeah, it's true. What was that room? Room 102 in Guelph, University of Guelph? There was a venue, little venue.
Room 10 something in the University Center, yeah.
Yeah. That's where I played a few. We played with Flag Camp there. Red Fisher did,
actually. Oh, nice.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And they had just worked with Steve Albini for that record they did.
That's right.
Yeah, and then they came in. Oh, man, that's where I first met. I don't know if you know Mark Crane. That's the first time I met Mark Crane.
Mark Crane did sound for my hideous rock band that I'm not going to name on this podcast.
Okay, wow. We know a lot of the same people. That's interesting. We've never actually spoken and met in person. What part of Toronto did you grow up in?
Scarborough,
okay.
Markham and Lawrence, Orton Park.
Okay, yeah. And did you grow up there, or did you were you in different parts of Canada?
Born and raised in Scarborough. I've really only lived three places in my life. I went to school in Guelph, stuck around there for 12 years. Went to Montreal to work for CBC's Brave New Waves, and then moved back to Toronto 12 years ago.
Okay. When you lived in Guelph, did you know a guy named Danny Evans worked at a bookstore there somewhere close to where the trash tier is? Him and his girlfriend owned a bookshop down in Guelph. Coffee shop.
Or Macondo Books.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. He played in my band. I had a band I put together called Foursquare, and he was our original bass player. Yeah, and that had two members of Two Line Filler, if you remember that band. That was an early 90s power pop band from the days gone by.
No, now you're getting too punk rock.
Ah, I'm sorry. I'll dial it back. Yeah, punk rock meaning, I lived in my parents' house, and I had purple hair, and I had a van and a band and a plan.
And a copy of Get in the Van.
Yeah, a copy of Get in the Van and the book, the audio book of Get in the Van. And then
I actually never heard that.
It's funny. Yeah. It's narrated by Rollins. It's very funny because it's too serious. It's way too serious, man.
Of course it is. It's intense.
Yeah. When you're talking about getting older and being in a band, that's kind of what this show is about. That's funny that you sort of hit on that earlier. And there's a certain time in your life where you go, I'm not going to be Bon Jovi. I'm not going to be the band X that makes it. My success in music is what makes me happy. And I'll go make money somewhere else. And then the interesting crossover point to that is when you're 25 and you're like, I want to be in a band, or I want to be an author, or I want to do this. And then as you get older, your priorities change. And then you start going, you know, I love music. I'm going to do it for the love. But the 25-year-old will be like, come on, quitter. You know what I mean? Like, what are you doing? Because the 35-year-old is like, I got to pay my mortgage, you know? Did you find that parallel as an artist?
With the Tragically Hip?
No, just you in general.
Or me in general. I mean, I'm at a crossroads right now. So I just finished this book. I spent a year working on it. It's doing extremely well. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, I need to find a job.
Yeah.
Like, what's your next? I need a job.
Yeah.
Because I don't have a paycheck coming in. Mm-hmm. I'm 46 and I'm at that point where it's like, well, you know, writing is an unpredictable life. And I was very fortunate right before I wrote this book, I worked at McLean's for 8 years and I was a copy editor there, which meant I wasn't there for my ideas, right? So they're not going to write about a lot of the obscure music that I would like to write about. So I have a job at this very interesting place with brilliant writers and brilliant editors that I can learn from. And then I can write about music on the side for other publications, you know, do the thing I love for next to no money because no one will pay you to write about music.
Yeah.
So I was doing the thing I love on the side and I had a very interesting day job. So I would love to have something like that again. But I mean, ideally I'd love to make a living writing about music, but that's incredibly difficult to do in general, but especially in this country.
Yeah. I have a friend who used to write for the Toronto Star and then went back to the Toronto Star. His name is Will McGurk. And he's a yes. writer based out of Oshawa. And he's a dear old friend of yep. mine. And I've known him for, gosh, since 30 years. And
I just met him for the first time last month.
He's a good man. He's a good yeah. man.
We're doing an event together in Uxbridge June 14th.
That's where I live. That's my town. Where?
What? Really?
Yeah, that's my hometown. I live in Uxbridge.
That's crazy. We're doing something at the Second Wedge Brewing thing.
Yeah.
Blue Heron Books is putting it on.
No way. Okay.
Yeah, June 14th.
That's amazing. I have to look at that because I have a few things I'm doing, but I think I'm around. That's so funny. Well, that's interesting.
And Will is doing like the onstage interview kind of thing.
Will is... Sort of, as any Canadian or artist in general, he, like myself too, I mean, in a way, just kept close to the action. Like, there was a certain time in people's lives where they were artists, and then they sort of went, yeah, I got to get my shit together. And then they became normal people. I mean, normal people meaning they went and worked in offices or became lawyers and doctors and, you know, contributed into society in a way that... you know, their own way, you know, and there's people yeah. like us who kind of stayed with it and stayed close to it and mm-hmm. kept with it. And then there's a line between keeping yourself happy and keeping the ones around you happy, as well as understanding where and what you can contribute into this world of, you know, art and whatnot. Did you contemplate, or are you still contemplating all of that? Where it all fits, where you fit in.
All the time.
Yeah.
The end. What you said.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, I mean, I didn't, yeah, I'm sorry, I'm putting words in your mouth there, but.
No, that's fine.
Yeah. Do you have anything else in the horizon, or are you just sort of riding the wave of this book you've written?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, it's, could go any which way at this point. Obviously, I'd love to do another project like this or of this scale. Part of the problem I have is that this is kind of one of the most commercial things that I would be interested in. The Tragic Hip, obviously a very popular band, a huge news story in the last couple of years. A lot of other artists I really enjoy. I'm not sure there would be a market to write about them. Mm. You know, I'd love to write a book about someone like Mary Margaret O'Hara, for example, or I don't know. It's hard to say. But there are few people that I think would inspire a book as good as I think this one is, simply because, like I said, this band is really kind of a blank slate, a tabula rasa upon which people project a lot onto and think a lot about. So whether that's, you know, poetry and music, or whether that's hockey, rock, or whether that's in the last couple of years, how artists deal with disease and art, and whether that's consciously making a final album, or touring in some kind of debilitating condition. This band made us think about all these things, and they made us think about these things for 30 years. And obviously, of Gord Downie's last projects, certainly not the last, but one of his last projects was the Secret Path project, and that cracked open all kinds of discussion as well. So this band is really, really rich subject matter. That is just a blessing for any kind of writer to work with. So I'm hard pressed to think of something that would be as rewarding and that more than just a few people would also be interested in. I feel quite spoiled by having a subject matter like this.
Absolutely. And it needs to be something that you can associate yourself with. Otherwise, it might be challenging to say, sure you did it with your other job, like go write about this and, you know, make it compelling. I mean, that's sort of the task of writing, just like people, you know, write music that, you know, someone says, go write a song that sounds like this. And that's terribly hard to do. I mean, like, especially, you know, all the sound alike stuff that we hear. But
a friend of mine is a professional jingle writer, and does soundtracks and video game soundtracks. And that's your job. And his solo records that he first became famous for have a certain sound to them. And then that sound got used in a commercial, and he did very well off that. He didn't get rich off that commercial, but because that commercial is so popular, he is now a full-time musician doing all this stuff, but he makes all kinds of music that doesn't sound like the songs he naturally writes. Like, it's every genre and every texture and everything else. But from a writer's standpoint, I'd be really interested in ghostwriting for somebody, or anything that it doesn't have to be music. It doesn't have to be a story I'm familiar with. It doesn't have to be an area that I know much about. But I think there is a real art and challenge in good and concise writing. And I read a lot of books where I think, who edited this? You know,
like the Neil Young book, the Neil Young biography,
Shaky.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that, actually.
I don't know if I can get into it. I see it, but go ahead.
What did you not like about that book? I'm just curious.
Okay, so maybe we're talking about the same book, but the book I got his biography. It was his autobiography.
And, oh no! I didn't read the autobiography.
Okay, well here's what I hated about it.
Yeah,
and. Okay. It started off strong, but he also started off talking about what that music player he had, which was called, at first it was called like Pomo or Pono or something.
Pono, yeah.
And then it turned to True Tone or something else. So if you're an editor of a book and you have a 600-page book and you're talking about this Pono for 300 pages of it, and then 300 pages in changes name, wouldn't you want to go back and replace the word Pono with True Tone? That's issue number one. Issue number two, it's like the ramblings of an old man looking out a window and type like, dear diary, I'm looking out a window, there's water. It has absolutely no relevance to his story. You read that Keith Richards book and you're like, oh my God, every page is completely and utterly like compelling and exciting. But I read those two biographies back to back and went, who would put this out and why? And so the other, and number three, I think I've got to two. Number three was the chapters were either 3 pages long or 30 pages long. So if you think I'm going to read this in due time and then you get into the chapters and you're like, I want to finish the chapter before I go to bed, you know? And you're like, keep going and going and going. You get to the end of the chapter and you're like, oh, okay. Well, that was totally not fulfilling. It had no point. So
I think that I think Keith Richards most definitely had a ghost writer, and I do think that's a very well written and structured book. But it depends on the size of the celebrity and the ego. Often there's not a ghost writer, and you can really tell for all the reasons you just outlined. Mm-hmm. And and that's another difference between memoir and a book like mine, right? So mine is more a bird's eye view. Mine is talking to dozens of people with different perspectives who may not agree with each other. And part of my job is figuring out who to believe and, you know, just a more composite portrait. Whereas a lot of memoirs are quite rambly and can be very poorly edited. I found the Springsteen one very interesting for a lot of reasons. One of which is he apparently wrote it longhand, without a word processor. And, but also, there's a bit of old man stuff. He uses a lot of all caps, particularly in the beginning of the book. It tapers off towards the end, thankfully. But he is a very effective writer, and if you're a fan of his lyrics, or you enjoy watching him in interviews, it's the voice feels very authentic, and it really does feel like he's telling you these stories. And it could have been tightened up in a couple places, but generally I thought that was an excellent memoir. Yeah. But again, yeah, there's a huge difference between memoir and an unauthorized biography that's more of a big picture view.
Yeah, the Bruce Springsteen book I didn't read, but I got the gist of it because I have a friend who does a podcast on Bruce Springsteen, so I listened to his sort of take on the book, and I also listened to a few of his other interviews. He did an interview with Mark Maron on the WTF podcast, so he speaks a lot to, in the book, from what I gather, about his father issues. I mean, the issues he had with his dad and how he wasn't good enough for his father's acceptance. And I think we all kind of have a little bit of that in us, you know, but the part that he really didn't really bring too much of it into his records, which I found to be kind of interesting. Like, he always spoke he sings in characters, and he sings like, and not a lot of it sort of comes home to his personal, you know, Born in the USA is pretty on the nose at the same time. But when he did write,
the river is about his sister.
Yes. Yeah. And some of the best writing he did was in other people's characters that he had created, and people wanted to hear these characters, you know. And so a lot of that you can sort of extrapolate and go, well, he's hiding a bit of something, you know. So when the book came out, he started speaking more about his personal life, and I think that was always the thing about Bruce Springsteen. He was talking about, like, you start getting into a personal conversation, and he starts talking about farmers, and he starts talking about poverty, and he starts talking about things that deflecting on the real issues that he had. So I like the fact that the book kind of address these issues that he'd had and has, you know.
Yeah. I really like some of my favorite memoirs. One of them is Nile Rodgers of the band Chic. Mm-hmm. The best parts of that book are actually before he even joins a band. Like, the stories about his childhood are so crazy and fascinating. And I can't remember if that one was ghostwritten or not, but that's a great one. And another great one is Joe Jackson. Have you read that one?
No, but I love Joe Jackson.
Okay, this is an amazing book, and it stops right before his first record comes out.
Oh, wow.
And it really is, he's an incredible writer, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And again, like, kind of a bit of a messed up family situation, and he's kind of like an ugly, nerdy, hyper-intellectual kid who doesn't fit in with anything. And, you know, he joins like a punk rock band, and they're playing like really crappy bars in small town Britain. Like, I think every musician should read that book, because it's an amazing encapsulation of what it's like to be nobody playing the worst gigs in the world and knowing that you're better than this.
Yeah.
And that you'll break out in this Springsteen kind of way. Eventually you will be born to run.
I just had I've got it for Christmas, but it's the Elvis Costello autobiography, and I got through the first couple of chapters, and then my life got so busy that I still have to pick up on it. But that's a book I want to finish, because I'm a big Elvis Costello fan too, and he speaks a lot about it. Sort of like talks about how he witnesses his his little brother or his brother being hit by a car and killed in front of him, and how it really truly affected who he was and everything forward about what type of person he became. And so I, you know, that's, you know, I think, I don't know if that was written by ghostwriter as well, but I think Elvis Costello would be maybe poignant enough to write his own stuff, you know?
Yeah, I haven't read that, but I've heard a lot of people say that's another one that could have been edited differently or structured differently. Yeah, and then similar to the Joe Jackson thing, the Moby one that came out a couple years ago is also an amazing book.
Really?
And again, it stops, not before his first record, but it stops right before he becomes massively successful. Mm-hmm. Like that huge record of his, he had basically given up. He'd been dropped by his label. He was like, I'm just going to make one more record and then do something else. Like, obviously I've bottomed out and my career is going nowhere. And the book ends with him putting on the finished record and driving from like New York back to Connecticut where he grew up. And it's an amazingly constructed scene. But again, the point is like, it's all the early struggles and then it stops as soon as you become successful. And really that's where the most interesting narrative for most artists is really, right? Because unless you are Keith Richards and all the craziest stories come later. You know?
Yeah. 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 The Slash book is pretty good too. If you read that biography book, it's a good read. And it's concise and it does not hold any punches back about what he thinks of Axl Rose and other bands and things. He truly speaks.
So, we're talking about these books and then here's mine, where you have a bunch of like well-adjusted middle-class guys who are successful right away. So not a lot of struggle there. And then they tick along and plateau, and then later records don't do as well. And then tragedy strikes, and then there's kind of a dramatic ending, but part of the challenge is how do you make their story interesting and finding those nuggets and those challenges that took place even while they were at their commercial peak. Because there's no scandal with this band, and there's no there's no addiction issues or you know, all the juicy things that make a lot of other rock books super interesting for a lot of people. That doesn't necessarily exist with this band. So
no. No,
and that's part of the reason why I wanted to do all those thematic chapters as well, because if this was a book that was half the length, I don't think it would be very good or very interesting.
Yeah.
It would be like band becomes successful, tragic ending, the end. You know? So
did you have
that was a challenge.
Is there a chapter that says that a smart guy pulled the wool over dumb people's eyes?
No.
I mean, you think the common jock that was into Tragically Hip in the 90s wasn't really listening to the poetry as much. And I think until they got older, they started, you know what I mean? Like, there was a time when the hip became a poignant for making a message. And when they were like playing, when I saw them play at the Forum, Ontario Place Forum. Yep. And when the stage was still rotating around and things like that.
Yep.
There were so many drunk Lugans at that show that it almost kind of ruined it, you know, in a way for me, because I'm like listening to the words and I'm getting, and the experience of the performance was, if anybody ever saw Tragically Hip in the mid or to early to mid 90s, that was one of those moments where you're like, how is this happening? You know what I mean? Like it's a spectacle, you know? And when it became drunk Lugans throwing up in the parking lot, how a band that has such a weight in the Canadian industry and such a weight with artists, that's a weird story. I mean, that's the story that interests me, because it's almost like they're being educated on culture and it's sort of an underhand, not an underhanded way, but a different way of feeding it to the people. So,
well, I would disagree with you.
Okay.
Everything you just said is stuff that I believed at one point, and stuff that certainly my peer group believes. And there's a couple of things going on there. First of all, it's a rock and roll band. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens at rock and roll shows. People get very drunk and have a lot of fun and fall over. there's an uglier side to that as well, obviously. And that certainly happened at Tragically Hip shows. But I would argue that probably also happened at a lot of other rock shows. I don't think that's peculiar to this band. But, you know, because the Hip have this, like, appeal to the intelligentsia, if you will, you know, there's a lot of chin strokers who are like, oh, all these drunk people clearly don't understand poetry. And some of them did. And some of them do. And maybe they got into other things because of the Tragically Hip. I feel like there's, you know, I don't deny that there's a hooligan element there, but I really don't think you can paint such a broad audience with that brush, because there's going to be assholes in every crowd, and certainly in punk rock crowds and rock and roll crowds. And I know the band, that dichotomy always bothered the band as well. I think they felt like their fan base got a short shrift. But they're also really upset at some of the more disturbing behavior. I mean, on the last tour, Gord Downie made a point of saying, thank you to the women for coming back, right? Because for years there, your guys were up here acting like meatheads and it was uncomfortable and weird, but after a few years you came back and thank you. And this is at a time when he was not saying anything on stage, yeah. You know, for obvious reasons with his diagnosis and his condition. He was not a talkative guy on that last tour, but that is one thing he made a point of saying every single night. And then there's the famous gig where Daniel Lanois was pelted with bottles and toilet paper and everything else. And Downie came out and said, you know, this first song is for all the assholes who throw shit at musicians. And then he said a few other things too, but he was, you know, clearly really upset by that. But I do take issue with the fact that even those idiots, you know, were too thick to grasp the poetry or to, I think people are smarter than you give them credit for. And I think part of the appeal for the band was, a huge part of the appeal were the lyrics, and that people found so much in them. And you could take those lyrics on a lot of levels. Some of them are really abstract and hard to parse, and other ones seem to be very straightforward. So, you know, you might think that 50 Mission Cap is just about the year the Leafs won the cup. And it's like, well, no, it's actually about a dead guy in an airplane. And then the chorus jumps to like a Second World War narrative guy and some con man telling you a story. Like, but for a lot of people, all they need to hear are the words Leafs win the cup. And that's the most exciting thing in the world when it's underneath a huge rock riff. And that's fine, because that's how pop music works, you know? The best thing about the Tragically Hip is that there are all these other layers that were there should you choose to find them. And I think a lot of people did choose to find them. And that's part of the reason for their longevity and part of the reason why those songs still registered with people 30 years later, when after they'd taken the band for granted for years and then tragedy struck and then all these people came out of the woodwork and was like, oh yeah, these songs, this is different than every other rock band. You know, those early songs that sound like AC/DC riffs, there's a lot going on in the lyrics there that you will never hear in an AC/DC song. And that's one of those fascinating things about this band.
Well, I think my point was is that they have had a way to deliver a message in a palatable way that all areas of intelligence and of acceptance could receive. And I think that was the gift that they have or had and still have, I mean, as a band. I mean, I'm sure there's a new listener listening to a Tragically Hip record at the age of 12 going, well, my mind is exploding, because you know what I mean? Because when I was 10 and I heard the Beatles for one, like we're nine or 8 years old, heard the Beatles for the first time. That was like, what the hell is this? And, you know, the record at that point was only, it was 15 years old. So you think 15 years ago was a Tragically Hip record that came out, or even 20 years ago, and kids are listening to it and going, taking something away from it in their own way. And I think that was my point. I was, you know, I did draw a pretty broad stroke there, but I do generalize.
What's interesting to me, Well, what's interesting to me is I really tried to contextualize him in the international rock and roll history. I didn't want this just to be a Canadian story, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, who else is remotely like Gord Downie fronting a rock band? I mean, as a writer, I think that there's some parallels to Joni Mitchell. There's parallels to Paul Simon. I hear a lot of Paul Simon, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, some a bit to Leonard Cohen, but those people don't make rock music, right? And here's Gord Downie in front of a rock band singing lyrics like this. And the other big comparison is Michael Stipe. And I love REM, and I love Michael Stipe as a singer and as someone with some amazing phrases in his songs. I like his way with words, but he's nowhere near the lyricist that Downey is. Stipe is someone who very much
on a vibe.
But more into the sound of the words, right?
Yeah.
And then Downey does that occasionally as well. A lot of rock singers do that. This word just sounds good here. The phonetics of this riff, right? Like that's what a lot of rock lyric writing is. But so Stipe is more kind of an oral painter than a wordsmith, whereas Downey is most definitely a wordsmith, where every word is very specifically chosen.
Yeah, no, I'm a huge fan also of Neil Finn, and he writes in imagery, and that imagery is something that you can paint a story in your brain on his images, and and he tends to not even answer questions about that song. Dream It's Over, Don't Dream It's Over. What's that song about? You know what I mean? Like, and he's sort of like,
I've wanted to know the answer to the question for years.
Yeah, I mean, there's certain things where you think there's a song on there called Hole in the River. Well, I kind of know what that's about, but because I went and he finally let some things out. But when I was 16 years old and I heard that song for the first time, I'm like, holy shit. I mean, this is much heavier, because I was always a big Split Enz fan too. And when Split Enz put out records, it was like, it got heavy and deep and weird and poppy and dark, and you know, and that sort of things that sort of challenge you as a listener, you know. And you know, as a music, I enjoy music, I always try to find the good things in music. So even today's music, I listen to it and go, what do I like about this? You know, because I don't want to be the angry guy that like, what's this shitty Bruno Mars crap? You know, like how could this guy be so popular? But well, there's a lot of going on there. You know what I mean? Like a lot.
Not lyrically, but
no,
a lot of
but there's a lot going on with presentation, with conviction. And I mean, there's a lot of things to be said about, you know, it's great to have great lyrics and things, but it's your conviction in the message that you're delivering, and that is as important as having great words. It's, you know, I stopped using it, but I used to say, if you could just say baby 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 and mean it, I'm okay with that. But then Justin Bieber came, had the song called Baby Baby Baby, so I'm like, okay, I'm gonna take that back a little bit, because that you know, I'm gonna take that back a little bit. I just don't get that. So I mean, and you know, I think as listeners of band like The Hip get older, they find different things, kind of like what the Beatles were. Like when I was a kid, I really enjoyed Paul McCartney. Then I got into, I was a Ringo, then I was Paul, then I was John, and then eventually George. So there's sort of like that era of Tragically Hip that has those type of benchmarks of where they sat and where they were, that later on I can go back and listen to records and go, oh yeah, I never liked this before, but I like this now because I'm a different person, you know.
That's exactly what happened to me last year while writing it. I mean, there were records that I had totally written off and went back and found a lot of great things on them. And there's really only one record that I can't listen to at all, and the rest of them, there's, you know, at least half the record is amazing for any other record. So
yeah, like I mean, when Fully Completely came out, that was, and then what was after that? The red one.
Day for Night.
Day for Night.
Day for Night was after.
Yeah. Yeah. There's moments in my life where I hear that song, A Long Time Coming. I'm like, oh my God, I know exactly where I was when I heard that song, and I know exactly what mood I was in. And and that's my like touching off point of going, oh my God, like it transports you back to where you were when you first heard it. It's very, yeah, it's very powerful. Music in general is powerful like that. Like when I first, go ahead.
I was going to say that's part of the reason I chose the title. It's a name of a Gord Downie solo song, but and it applies to a lot of things, his approach to performance and their approach to their career, always looking forward and not just resting on laurels, but also what you're talking about there, and that music is the never-ending present. And we can, I can discover Van Morrison and Them and go down a wormhole and it sounds fresh and new and exciting because I haven't heard those records before. And like you said, the 12-year-old can pick up the hip discography tomorrow and it will be totally fresh with them.
Yeah.
And these songs that landed so hard with us 25 years ago, we hear them now and we're instantly transported back to those. Like it's such a huge continuum. And also music does things to us that other art forms don't, because it is always present in that way. Like your favorite novel, maybe you'll read it two or three times in your life, mm-hmm. if you're lucky. Your favorite film, are you going to watch it more than maybe five times in your life? Your favorite album.
Every day.
Is with you all the time.
Yeah.
And when you first fall in love with it, you're listening to it constantly. And those songs are burrowed in your brain. And I think music just has a very different function than the other arts that way. It's always present.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of things like an alchemy of situation that gets you into music. For instance, it's a bad example, but it's kind of an example. Bob Marley sounds better on a beach at an all-inclusive resort with a drink in your hand. And that's just me. That's to me. Like if someone played it on the radio, I'm like, okay, I hear Bob Marley. I get it. I've never owned an album, but when I'm in a location that feels tropical and warm and everybody's happy and everybody's there for a happy reason, when I hear Is This Love, I'm like, this is the best song I've ever heard in my life, and that's music. And that's how it sort of, all these little benchmarks are hit and all these little checkpoints are checked and you go, okay, when I first heard, we were talking about Death Cab for Cutie. When I first heard The New Year, I was in Europe driving to Amsterdam to play a show. And I had never heard that record, Transatlanticism, before. Yes. And I put it on and we listened to every song in complete silence. And I was like shivering, like with goosebumps. Like it was the most exciting thing I'd heard in 20 years, 30 years, maybe, ever since I heard Jesus, All My Lovin' by the Beatles or something, I was like,
a big fan of that.
Yeah, that record for sure. I mean, like that was like every song was like, wow, how do they do that? And then so I became a huge fan, even though I'd heard of them before, and mm-hmm. all the little check marks were checked. I mean, that's exciting about music because it affects us all in different ways at different times. But what makes a band popular is when everybody feels kind of the same thing at the same time and then can mm-hmm. relate to it. And that's popularity. I mean, everything with art is sort of like when you create art, you don't kind of create art to be popular, successful. You do it to validate your artistic endeavors. You know what I mean?
Right.
But if it becomes successful, to me, that's gravy. Do you feel that way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are certainly people who tailor what they do to make it more popular. And sometimes that really works. And sometimes you can see right through it. Sometimes what they do just happens to be very popular. What's frustrating, I think, is when an artist you love because there's something very unique about them, and then they make a record that just smooths over all their edges. And they do something that really seems to smack of conformity and you're like, why would you do that? And sometimes it isn't a very honest, it does come from a very honest place. They have a sudden interest in pop music, so they want to sound like everything else on the radio. And then But other times it's just really a crass thing. I mean, back to my subject matter, I never liked the album Fully Completely, which is the Hips' most commercially successful album, still their most beloved album. Mm-hmm. But I didn't like the production on it. I didn't like the way it sounded. This was a band I went to see live many times between like 88 and 91, including at the Forum. Mm-hmm. And then this record just sounded like a bad radio rock band. Like that kind of chemistry they had that was so evident on those first two, which is also what we saw live. Later on, I found out how it was made, and it was made the way a lot of records are made, especially in the 90s. You know, let's do the bass and drums for 2 weeks and nothing else, and then throw all the guitars on at the end.
Triggering.
And triggering, totally. Yeah. And you can tell. Yeah. And that's what that record sounds like. And there's great songs on that, but I'd rather hear them on a live album than listen to Fully Completely again. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of fell off for a couple of years. That kind of turned me off the Tragically Hip for a couple of years. Meanwhile, they became bigger than ever. So what do I know, right? So, but it was a calculated move to get on the radio.
Yeah,
right. They wanted a radio hit. They wanted something that sounded huge.
Yeah.
Whereas those first two records really stood out in the late '80s, early '90s because they didn't sound like any other record. Because a lot of rock and roll, even great rock bands like The Replacements, sounded like shit in the studio.
Oh yeah,
and here comes the Tragically Hip, and it's like, wow, that's what rock music should sound like, you know?
Yeah, yeah. There was a funny moment. I mean, it's not to do with the Hip, but it's to do with the Bare Naked Ladies. When I was like, there was one moment like I'm like, whatever happened to the Bare Naked Ladies? Where did they go? And then that one America. Week song came out, and I'm like,
yep.
What? How did this completely under my notes? Like. Yeah. And then I hear it on the radio. It was literally that day going, here's this new song from the Bare Naked Ladies. I'm like, I didn't know they were a band still. And they went to America and became a cult classic famous band, like big time, with college radio and college touring and things like that. And just toured. And toured
I don't know if they're a cult band if they've sold millions of records, but.
Yeah. Well, I mean.
But that question of where did they go, that is where they went. They ignored Canada for a couple of years because Canada didn't give a shit about them anymore. Mm-hmm. Like they peaked very early and then there was like a big backlash. So they went to the States, worked their ass off, like playing every radio station barbecue, every like, you know, fan contest thing, whatever. They did that for like 2 years straight and it was a total grassroots thing. That by the time that next record came out, even though that's such a terrible song, it debuted at number one and then they were set.
Yeah.
So
when they played, I worked as a stage hand on the Skydome SARS Fest thing where they did a show at ACC and Skydome at the same time. And they were flip flopping between the two venues. And then I saw the stage was somehow, it was 12 feet in the air. And my joke was just to keep all the SARS away. So then none of the bands would get the SARS. But I had never seen anybody command 50,000 people at the Skydome. And I worked the Bruce Springsteen show there. I worked a Rolling Stone show there. But Stephen Page had literally them. I don't know if you can see my hand, but he had them in their hand. So he would make them raise up and make them go down. And he had this power that I could not believe. And I was like, holy shit, this is a band. And to be able to speak to that person way up there on the 500 level, as well as that person 12 feet below you, because you don't want to get the SARS. But I could not believe the power. And I met Stephen Page because I did monitors for the Transit Canada Highwaymen, which is, Moberg,
Nordy, Chris Murphy.
Yeah. And they were just amazing. And it was still there. You know what I mean? Even though they're playing my venue with 630 people, it was like, still got it. You know what I mean? Like, and that's a band I think people want to see get back together like that, I think.
Well, who knows what's going to happen now? Yeah. I never saw them play for that many people before. I saw them very early and then somewhat recently and not in between. So, I never saw them in front of a huge audience.
It was like amazing. I worked a show for a band that opened up for them called the Hebe G in Bowmanville, and we played Bowmanville High School and opening for the Bare Naked Ladies. And I told him my steak-eating story because the promoter got everybody steaks. So I met them for the first time and they're like, go get a steak. I'm like, yeah. Okay. So I get a steak. And then I found out like a year later, I had eaten the promoter steak. So I told Stephen Page the story like literally 4 months ago. I said, yeah. And he goes, that after I saw him, he goes, don't eat anybody's steaks as I'm leaving. He goes, try not to eat anybody's steaks. And his son actually plays in the Richmond Hill Philharmonic Orchestra.
Oh, yeah.
So I see him occasionally at that because where I work is the Richmond Hill Center for the Performing Arts. So I see him occasionally. Yeah, great, great band. And they even back then, like they're playing in the high school in front of 200-300 mm-hmm. kids. And it was like amazing. Like,
I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Just always bound for something, you know, like for greatness. And it's funny. You see bands and you go, wow, I can't believe you got there. How did you get there? And then a lot of it is because, well, A, they can play, but a lot of it is luck, you know? And
yeah.
You know, do you, I guess this would be the last question, but do you believe in luck? I mean, do you believe in hard work versus fate? Do you believe in putting the work in to get a result? Like, what? Where do you sit in all this, especially with writing? And
for writers, it's work. Yeah. It's definitely work. It's the quality of your work and showing up and delivering on time is huge. Mm-hmm. Quality and professionalism will get you everywhere. A little bit of luck helps. When it comes to music, it really is all luck, because obviously some not very talented people become very popular through luck or networking or timing or something. But if you're playing the long game, you obviously need the talent. What I find interesting about Tragically Hip is that they really are relics from a time when you start out as a band, you play the same town four nights in a row, doing four or five sets a night. I mean, tell that to a band of 20-year-olds now. Tell that to a band of 30-year-olds now.
Yeah.
Even 40-year-olds. Like, that is how you become a band, you know? That chemistry is built into you when you are playing those kind of gigs in front of people who really don't give a shit in Timmins or wherever you are. And Bare Naked Ladies, also, you know, incredibly hardworking. So then you have a band like The Hip, who are obviously, great, strong work ethic. It pays off in Canada for a variety of reasons. And then when it comes to the States, they have, there's a lot of bad luck with record labels, with timing, with trends. You know, there's a lot of factors why they didn't break at the same level they did in Canada, and it's largely to do with luck. Now, as we said before, eventually they carved out a career as kind of like a cult band, and by the end of their career, they were playing for more people than they ever played in the States, right? It kept getting better in the States. Mm-hmm. But certainly the reason why they never broke at the same level they did here was totally luck. Because you can have the talents and you can have the songs and you can have everything else, but it's the fluke that will really make you.
Mm. Well, that's a good way to end off. I appreciate you coming on the show and talking. And like I said at the very start, writing is something that to me I find fascinating because, A, I don't know, it seems romantic at the amount of work you put into it, and what you get out of it is something that it's different than music, but it's kind of the same. I mean, it has the same, you put work in and you get art out of it. It comes out of your brain, comes through your hands, and goes onto a piece of paper or into a computer. But the same thing happens with music. But with writing, I think you're at a little bit of a disadvantage because you have to create the imagery. You only have one way to do it, and it's the person reading it. I mean, that's the tricky part. We're artists. You have a few more other things, tricks in the bag as a musician. So,
right. Yeah. But writing is very lonely. And the best part of writing this book for me was interviewing all these people and, you know, just having an excuse to call up musical idols of mine and sit down and chat, and other people too. And just, the research is, and meeting people in person and listening to their stories is the best part of writing. Everything else is a bit of a chore and just a lot of carpal tunnel. But
well, if you ever do that Red Fisher biography, you know, I'm always here for a conversation if you want to talk.
Well, I hear there is an excellent history of the Winnipeg punk scene. I haven't read that yet.
Chris Walter do that? Is that Chris Walter?
That sounds familiar, yeah.
Yeah, he did one on SNFU. I'm actually, because I worked for SNFU in the 90s.
Oh, you're still alive. That's great.
Yeah, I'm still alive, and so are most of them. Most of them are still alive, too. Chris wrote one on Dayglo Abortions. He wrote, he does a lot of punk rock, and he's another author that I was trying to get on the show. He goes, I don't use computers. I'm like, okay, well, that might be tricky, because I'm not going to Vancouver in the next couple of years.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming on the show, Michael. I appreciate
it. Well, thanks so much for having me. This has been fun.
And there he was, Michael Barclay. Good episode. Nice chat. Good dude. Good fun times. Thanks, Michael, for doing the show. It was a good time. I want to remind everybody to go and support the show by going to betterhelp.com. You can go get a 7-day trial with the code word Apolog when you go to betterhelp.com/Apolog. I'd like to thank all the people shopping on Amazon. Apolog.ca/Amazon. Apolog.ca/USAmazon. Thanks to the patrons by going to patreon.com/Apolog. You can become a patron. That's how you work it out. All right. So it's going to be, I got a very, very special episode coming up next week. I'm very proud of it. And if it all comes together, I can tell you about it. But it hasn't really come together. It's probably going to come together tomorrow. It's not like the President of the United States or anything, but it's kind of a momentous moment where hopefully three old friends can get together and talk about something that they did 15 years ago. So anyways, have a great week. Have a great night. See you later.